irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and as we usher in the new year, I'm going to take this time to thank our guests and our listeners for being such an important part of this show. And I want to add special thanks to Jan Chapin. She's behind the scenes. She produces this show and makes Marvin and my job so much easier. This has been such a blessing for me, having Dr. Melody Fox on for so many years was wonderful, and I'm very happy for her that her practice got so busy that unfortunately she didn't have time for us, but the bottom line is that she's out there making a positive difference in the lives of people within her practice. And also for Marvin Smith. Marvin has become a part of this show, and I'm just so thankful for that. He also brings such great energy to this show, and for that I'm very thankful. But I want everybody to know, and unfortunately Marvin can't be with us at this show, but again, he's doing what he does. He's out there making a positive difference in the lives of others. But as usual, we will continue to bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, we will continue to address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions, and so many other things. Now, with each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we've been very fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors who share valuable stories and helpful information. And let me tell you, today we're going to be dealing with an author who has many valuable stories because that's what one of his books are about. And we'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today, Paul Smith, is a popular keynote speaker and corporate trainer in leadership and storytelling techniques, a former executive and 20-year veteran of the Procter & Gamble Company. Now, as the author of the widely praised Lead with a Story, he has seen his work featured in The Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, Forbes, The Washington Post, Success, and Investor's Business Daily, among other publications. Now, Paul earned his MBA from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania and now lives in Cincinnati, or actually a suburb of Cincinnati called Mason, with his wife and two sons. Now, his new book, Parenting with a Story, is a collection of the stories I just mentioned that are for inspiring sound decisions and good, strong decision-making and good character. Paul, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on, Alan.
Well, I want you to know I really appreciate it. I think this is a great way to start off the new year, and it really goes right to what this show is about. And that is, we want to help provide answers for families that are looking for things that might help them, that are looking at things that might inspire them. And, you know, when Jan told me about your new book, I thought, what a perfect way to bring in the new year. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, you bet. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So, why don't you give us a little bit of background? Because I know that, I mean, again, as I said, we started with, or you started with, you know, Lead with a Story, and now with your new book, Parenting with a Story, share with us a little bit about what brought you to the point that you decided that this is the direction you're going to go.
Yeah, well, I think the idea for this second book really came in the middle of the research for the first book. So the first one, as you mentioned, is more of a leadership book, and it's a collection of short stories from leaders all over the world when they learned their first and most important leadership lessons. And as I started sharing some of those stories with other people as kind of sounding board to just get some reaction to them, I heard some consistent feedback that they would often say, almost as an aside, after they gave me their thoughts on the story, they'd say, I really think I could use that same story at home, not just at work, with my kids. And I heard that from so many people that it finally dawned on me that there must be some pretty significant similarities between leading people at work and, parenting children at home. In both cases, whether you're leading an employee at work or parenting a child, you're in some ways in charge of that person. You in some ways get to tell them what to do. Your goal is their success. You're in charge of their development. You exercise some kind of authority over them. And so with all of these similarities, I guess in hindsight, it shouldn't have surprised me, but at the time I was surprised that people were yearning for similar stories, in some cases even the same stories, to use to better lead their children at home. And so that set me off on a whole new set of interviews. So I ended up interviewing another 100 people around the world. But more looking for life lessons and character building lessons instead of leadership lessons at work.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And we've talked about on this show in the past that sometimes the mistakes that parents make, while raising their children, while they're in that developmental stage, is they somehow think that they need to be their child's best friend, and mm-hmm. That doesn't work. And I've said to parents, your child does not need a 40-year-old best friend. Your child needs somebody. your child needs somebody to lead them. Your child needs somebody to help guide them. And so I just couldn't agree with you more that that leadership is something, it's a role that we are obligated to take as parents. And I'm so glad that you not only recognized it, but put together a book of stories that can help people see that if they're thinking about that, they're not alone. That's the way other people are doing it as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, you mentioned mistakes that we've made. I think we usually learn more from our mistakes than we do, I think, our successes. And it's not just our parenting mistakes. It's our life mistakes. I think most parents desperately want to impart the wisdom of their age to their kids, if for no other reason, to keep them from having to make all the same mistakes that we did. And I think many of us have learned the hard way that, a good personal story is often the best way to teach that lesson, as opposed to just wagging your finger at your kids and telling them, what to do. But the problem that I've found is that most of us, certainly me, we don't have enough great personal stories to teach all of life's lessons. I might have two or three or maybe four, and you might have two or three or four, and, somebody else might have two or three or four, but we need hundreds of these great stories to take a child all the way through adulthood and beyond. And that's why I thought, I certainly wouldn't want to write a book about, character development for kids based only on my own life experiences, because it'd be a very short book. So what I ended up doing, like I mentioned, similar to the first book, I ended up interviewing about 100 people, probably 20 different countries around the world and from all walks of life. And I was looking for not necessarily their parenting mistakes or successes. In fact, many of the people I interviewed are not parents themselves. In fact, many of the people I interviewed are children, right? And so, in fact, that was the only criteria I had in selecting people to interview, is that at some point in their life, they've been a child, right? Which is pretty much everybody, and because I wasn't looking for parenting advice. I was looking for life lessons. And so you don't have to be a parent to have lived life and made mistakes and learned lessons. So,
sure.
I interviewed these people and I was asking these questions like, tell me about a time in your life when you learned a very important but completely unexpected lesson, And after interviewing all these people, I ended up with probably 6 or 7 or 8 stories from each person. So I ended up with 600 or 800 stories. And as I tried to categorize them based on, what was the lesson learned in this story, they all fit into a very similar set of character traits. you know, things like ambition and open-mindedness and creativity and integrity and hard work and, you know, but also things about how you treat other people. So like kindness and patience and fairness and humility. And I was just really impressed and quite surprised that even though I've interviewed people from such a broad diversity of backgrounds and countries and cultures, that it was these same 20 or so character traits that kept popping up. And so I guess that just encouraged me that I think we're far more similar than we are different.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that was so impressive to me is the fact that, that things are within a certain category, and that would allow somebody, maybe a parent who is thinking, gosh, how do I explain to my child that they're at that age to where, you know, they need to be more open-minded, or something has happened at school, and maybe they've been bullied, and I just want to teach them a little bit of grit. You know, I want to, and so to me, that was so nice to be able to go, oh, there's a category for that, and you can go and read different stories and go, okay, this one kind of fits. Let me go with that. So I love that part of it.
Yeah, in fact, I'm actually hoping that people use the book in some ways like you just described, as opposed to just, well, here's a book, let me sit down and read it cover to cover, which of course is fine, and I'm sure many people will do that, but I think it's even more useful opportunistically, like you described, when you realize your kid is in need of a certain, you know, lesson. Then, you know, flip to the chapter that's got that, you know, got that lesson in it, and then you've got four or five great stories right there to use at your fingertips.
Right, and I love the fact you mentioned, I mean, all of us have a few stories, and I'm smiling because I'd love to have one of my sons on right now, because they could probably point out how, you know, they'll roll their eyes sometimes, especially if they're around their friends, and they'll go, oh man, don't, Dad has come up with another way to turn this into a learning experience, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry he's not here too, because we can often learn a lot from how they respond to our lessons. But I think every parent gets that kind of reaction from kids if they're trying to teach their kids something. The reaction that you don't want is them rolling their eyes and go, oh, you're not going to tell me that story about you in junior high again when you did the what, you know, whatever. In other words, the story that you've already told them 20 times.
Right.
You know, that story's already played out. They've already heard it. They've either learned from it or they haven't. You can remind them of the story, but you don't need to tell them the story over again. And the reason why we do that is, like I mentioned, we don't have enough stories all on our own. You know, you need to augment your quiver of arrows, I guess I would say, with other people's stories, so that you've got new and different and insightful stories to respond to those situations with, instead of just trotting out your own kind of tired stories over and over again.
Yeah, you know, and I'm curious. I mean, did you do any as far as research, as far as going back? Because as you're saying that, I'm thinking that, you know, if you go back, you know, a couple of hundred years when you had, you know, maybe, you know, three different generations, you know, all living in the same household, I would think there was a time in which there was more stories, you know, of their own. You know, in other words, they may have had a few more stories of their own because of the fact that you had, you know, more people in a home, you had more generations, so you didn't just have your parents, but you had your grandparents in many cases in the same home. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's an astute observation. I think the answer is yes. I believe that's true for the reason you stated, because often there was more than one generation under a roof, but also for a number of other very important reasons. Like the time that people used to sit around and share their stories was over dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when you used to eat dinner with your kids?
Yep.
We don't do that anymore because our kids come home and they're distracted with, you know, it's either too much homework or an overscheduled social life, or, you know, soccer practice here and basketball practice there, and, you know, or you're competing for their attention with all of their, you know, video games and cell phones and all this kind of stuff. You know, 100 years ago, life really was a little bit more simple. There weren't all those distractions, and people were expected to sit down and have dinner, and instead of the TV being on while dinner was happening, you know, mom and dad's mouths were on, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and your mouths were on, and everybody shared what happened to them that day, and you know, whether it was good or bad, and that's how kids learned about what it meant to be a grown-up, and we just don't do that anymore, and so I think that is one of the primary reasons why we don't tell our kids as many stories, is because we've lost the venue for telling them.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you can share a few stories again, and I want to say for those people out there, again, if you're listening and you're not driving, if you're at a computer, you can follow along with us. You can go to the website, which is leadwithastory.com. So if you go to leadwithastory.com, you can kind of get an idea of what it is that we're talking about here. And again, for those that haven't read it, if you can just share a couple of stories, maybe in each category, that can sort of give an idea. So if we took, say, ambition, you know, and your child is at a point in which you think that maybe it's time that you have to discuss that with him, you know, what might be a story you would pull out that's one of your favorites in that category?
You know what? Let me do this if I could. Let me start with one, a more personal story that I think will be easier for me to illustrate a story, and then how you would use that story and how your kids might react to it.
That'd be great.
And it's a personal story of mine, so it's familiar and one of my favorites. So when I was about 17 years old, my father helped me get a job at the company where he worked, and he was an executive at the company in some department. And of course, I was at 17, now the newest kid and the lowest man on the totem pole. And so I quite literally was a file clerk, and I swept the floors and all that kind of stuff. So I was excited to have a job, but I was even more excited when I found out that one day a year, my boss was required to take me out and buy me lunch. And it was, and this was back in the mid-80s, and it was on the day that at the time they called Secretary's Day. Now, I'm sure it goes by a different name today, but back then it was Secretary's Day, and I was technically a secretary, so my boss had to buy me a free lunch. Well, of course, all the managers had to take their secretaries out to lunch that day, so the company that we both worked for kind of rented out one of the rooms at a local restaurant, and we all showed up, you know, en masse at the same time, and they had prepared two meal options that day. One was a club sandwich, and one was a quiche Lorraine. And now, this, like I said, this is back in the mid-80s, and it's right after that book, Real Men Don't Eat Quiche, came out. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do.
Yeah. So it was a bestseller, and even if you didn't read it, you already know what it's about. I mean, it was this tongue-in-cheek look at the feminization of the American male. And so even people that hadn't read the book were, if you were a man at that point, you absolutely would not eat a quiche because it would just identify you as a less than masculine person. Mm-hmm. So, of course, none of the men were ordering the quiche Lorraine. They were all ordering the club sandwich. And, of course, when the waitress got around to me, I very quickly ordered the club sandwich because at 17 I was already insecure enough in my masculinity. I didn't want to add to my problems. Well, when it got to my dad, who happened to be sitting at the same table as me, he said to the waitress, well, you know, I've never had a quiche before, so how about this? How about you bring me half a quiche and half a club sandwich? That way, if I don't like the quiche, I still got, you know, half a club sandwich. Well, the other men at the table just immediately descended on my dad with all just ridicule, and on a family-friendly show, I won't tell you the words that they said, but you can imagine that they were questioning his masculinity in very colorful language, I'll say.
Yep.
And to me, I was just mortified, right, that here my dad is getting dressed down by these men in a pretty crude fashion in front of me, so I was terribly embarrassed. I don't know if he was, but I was terribly embarrassed. Well, after 4 or 5 minutes of all this ridicule, you know, he finally had had enough, and he called the waitress back over, and of course all the guys at the table started high-fiving each other, you know, celebrating their victory. They, you know, they'd broken his spirit, right? Uh-huh. And the waitress gets over and he apologizes. He said, "I'm sorry, I've got to change my order. You know, I ordered a half a club sandwich and half a quiche. I need you to take back that half a club sandwich, and I need you to bring me the entire quiche." And I got to tell you, the table was silent, you know, like jaws hit the table. And when she brought his quiche, he ate that whole thing with a smile on his face. I've since come to learn, by the way, that he doesn't like quiche, and that's the first and last quiche he ever ate in his life. But he ate it all with a smile that day. And it just, that moment, you know, my respect for my dad just hit an all-time high, because even without trying, you know, that moment taught me a lesson about what it really meant to be a man or an adult, and to just not care so much what other people think of you, and how to stand up to peer pressure. Now, so I tell that story to my kids. So I've got a 14-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy here at home. And so I've told them that story a couple of times. And so now if they suffer some kind of peer pressure at school, so for example, if one of the kids is teasing my son for not pulling his pants down and hanging off his waist, you know, as is unfortunately fashionable these days, you know, what's he supposed to do? So he comes to me and says, hey, Dad, they're teasing me at school because, you know, my pants are pulled up around my waist instead of hanging down. And, you know, I could just say, well, son, stand up to peer pressure and, you know, don't, you know, stand up to bully and I'll back down. And, you know, I could give him the platitudes that all parents give, and then he would still be left not knowing what to do. Well, what does that mean, Dad? Am I supposed to walk away or get in a fight or argue with him? Or like, you know, that really is not that helpful. But since I've told him the story about my dad eating the quiche, all I have to say to him is, well, son, have you tried eating the quiche? And then he remembers the story, and he goes, oh, okay, maybe I should try doing the opposite of what they're teasing me about. I mean, do it more instead of do it less. So
right.
The next day he goes to school, he pulls his pants up even higher. You know, and then they say, no, dummy, we said pull them down. And he pulls them up even higher. Well, now he looks like Urkel walking around, right? I mean, but you can see how quickly his tormentors would get frustrated and just walk away, you know. So now he's successfully navigated that situation without getting in a fight, without arguing with anybody, without name-calling, I mean, without any of that, by just following the lead of the character in the story.
You know, I love that, and it made me think of another thing that I think helps not only with our kids but with anybody, and that is the pay it forward part of a story like this, and that is where you tell a story like that, and then the pride that you have when your kids don't know that you're around and you hear them telling a similar story to another one of the kids, and I actually have a story like that in regards to our what we do with transporting at-risk youth, and I transported a young man to a program, and this particular program allowed them to remain dressed the way that they normally are. You know, the way that they normally dress for the first couple of weeks, and then slowly would have them conform. But anyway, this particular young man was sagging, like you brought up.
Yeah.
So his pants are sagging way down, and I'm taking him to a program. You know, and so I told him a story in regards to that about, you know, where that started. So I told him a story about, you know, it having started in prison, and that the more masculine guys wore their pants normally, and they used the less masculine guys, and that's how they could identify them, was they would, yeah. Have their pants sag down like that. And so I just told the story and then didn't say anything else about it. I just left it alone. And a few months later, these young people that go to this particular program, they're allowed to go home for the holidays. So they go, but they have us pick them up to take them home. So I'm picking up one young man to take him back home, the same young man. And there was another boy who was brand new. He had only been there for a few days, but he was still getting to go home. And something had occurred, whoever it was that was supposed to take him, because of flight delays or whatever, he couldn't make it. So I said, don't worry about it. I can take him, as far as, because we had to go on a bus to go to a bigger airport and stuff. But anyway, as we're on the bus, we sit down and they sit over in the two seats and I sit right across the aisle. And I just lean, after we get going, it's going to be about 2.5 hour ride. And I lean my head back and I go to, as I'm going to sleep, and I hear the boy who I had talked about a few months earlier turn to the other boy and go, you know what? I'm going to tell you, you know, do you know where that got started?
Yeah.
Do you want to know why I don't do that again? And I kept my eyes closed, and inside I had this huge smile.
Nice.
You know, it's now being paid forward, because, as you said, not because I did anything more than just share a story. I didn't condemn it or anything else. I just shared. So
yeah,
anyway, so
great.
As you were saying that and you mentioned about the sagging, it made me think of that. And I think that the paying it forward, have you found that now where you're getting, as you've, you know, as the book has been out there and stuff, where people are talking about, you know, that not only has it helped in this case, but it's now being paid forward to another sibling?
That's of course the goal is not for these stories to be shared once and never again. If it's a good story, people are going to continue to share it. In fact, that's one of, I think, the hallmarks of success of a story is if you end up hearing your story again, but somebody didn't know it was your story, that means it's really gotten it's gotten around, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody's telling you as if you didn't know it because you know they didn't know it originated with you. That's the mark of a real successful story.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break, but again, I want to share with everybody that we're talking about the new book by Paul Smith. It's called Parenting with a Story. So again, we're going to take a break. We will be right back. And again, if those of you that are online, you can go to www.leadwithastory.com and follow along with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And you're back. And you're listening to Answers for the Family. We're talking with Paul Smith, and his new book is called Parenting with a Story, a collection of stories for inspiring sound decision-making and strong character. So, Paul, when we took a break, we were talking a little bit about sort of paying it forward, these stories now moving on, and the good stories continue to go out there and continue to grow. So share with us a little bit about, as you were putting this together, what questions did you feel were the ones that were going to best prepare you to put this book together?
Yeah, you know, they turned out not to be the questions that I thought they were going to be. you know, I thought I could just pretty simply ask people to, you know, tell me your best, you know, life lesson stories. And I found out pretty quickly that that question went nowhere fast. And I think the reason why is because most of us don't think of our most meaningful life experiences as stories. You know, that we think of them as events in our lives, and they only become stories to us, you know, once they're if it's something somebody else told us. But if it's something that happened to us, we just don't think of them that way. So when you ask somebody for a story, those things don't come out. In fact, I learned that lesson for certain when I shared one of the stories. I'd written up a draft of the story after an interview with this one woman and sent it to her, and she wrote back, "Oh, well, I didn't know that's the kind of thing you were looking for. That's not really a story. That's just something that happened to me one time." Well, yeah, that's exactly what a story is. It's something that happened to you, somebody, sometime. You know, so what I had to completely change the way I did the interview. So the questions that were more successful at eliciting really good stories were questions about specific moments in time. So things like, you know, tell me about a time in your life when you learned a very important but completely unexpected lesson, or what's the biggest mistake you've ever made and why, or what are your biggest three regrets in life, or, you know, the smartest decisions you've ever made, or describe a vivid memory you have as a child where you felt terrible about how you made somebody else feel, you know, or a time you were really afraid of something. And so it's, in general, these, they're open-ended questions, but they're specific enough to elicit a specific memory in their brain. And when you ask about interesting enough moments in someone's life, it's almost certain to yield an interesting life story where a lesson was learned. So once I started using those questions, I started having a lot more success with the interviews. In fact, those questions and several others that I found successful are in the last chapter of the book, because I recommend to people after they've read the book, you know, don't just rely on these stories that I've given you here. You ought to start coming up with your own life stories and hear the questions that if you interviewed yourself and asked these questions, you're certain to find some things you didn't know were there.
Yeah, and I thought that was great. And also the fact that if you were getting some of these stories, did you find that that one story actually led to another or to a better one or to something that maybe they didn't even recognize?
Oh yeah. So there are certainly some stories that people told me that are stories they've told before, and that's fine. And some of those were very good stories, but there were very clearly some stories that people had never told anybody else before because nobody had asked them the questions that I asked. And oftentimes they were embarrassing, unfortunate, you know, mistakes in their life that they were ashamed of. And so they didn't want to talk about them very much. And some of those people were kind enough to let me use their real name in the book, and some, you know, preferred not to. So they're anonymous in the book. But that's when we learn some of our best life lessons, is when we've made a mistake, right? And those are the kind of things people don't like to talk about a lot, which is unfortunate, right? Because your kids, I mean, you love them, right? You want them to learn from your mistakes, and they can't if you don't share them.
Exactly, and that's how people continue to repeat things, is because they didn't share it, so the next generation repeats the same mistake as opposed to learning from it. So I could not agree more. And yet at the same time, I can remember asking questions, you know, of my father, and realizing that at times he would give a story, and I was to make what I wanted out of that. And I remember at one time where I asked something in regards to a real relationship type of thing, and by now I was about 18 or 19, and he said, you know, rather than tell you a story, I'm just going to tell you that that's one of those big guy questions you're going to have to figure out on your own.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and because of that, because I think there is a point in which, you know, that what they're saying is that, you know, you're now of an age to where, you know, you might want to think about that and just think about the other stories that you have been told. You know, where are you going to take this now? So, yeah, you know, it's definitely something that I think is very helpful. And I think it also, you know, would you say that by doing this, and as you're talking to these people, did you feel like it was sort of bringing them closer together to their own family, even as they thought about this, or would then talk to other family members about it?
Yeah, you know, one of the other common responses I would get at the end of these interviews was they would thank me and tell me that this felt like therapy, and they felt like they should pay me as some kind of a psychologist or something, which I'm clearly not. But just the process of being so introspective and being asked these pointed questions about your past and what you've learned and mistakes and successes is quite therapeutic. And so people ended up often after the interview, then, you know, go hug their wife and kids, and they wanted to share some of these stories with them that they had just shared with me, some of which they'd never shared before. And so, yeah, I think it is a very cathartic exercise to go through, even if there's not somebody else interviewing you, even if you're doing it yourself. I think it can definitely help bring out some things you knew you didn't know were there, and that can help bring you closer together with your family.
All right. Well, we have an email coming through from a listener, and this one reads, I grew up in a wonderful family in North Carolina. I was so thrilled when I viewed your topic, as I remember vividly my grandparents and great aunts and uncles sharing the most amazing stories with me about the good times and some the not so good times.
Yeah.
A wealth of courage and solutions that I have drawn on to this day. My question is, do you find that the kids of today think they have such access to information that our stories aren't relevant to their world? And does your book give us guidelines on how to get through to them anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what I have found is that, at least in the kind of stories that I tend to traffic in, they're not only pretty universal, but they're fairly timeless. I mean, you're not going to find stories in my book about how should you deal with a cyber stalker, or how to respond to a text versus if it's in person versus if it's email. I mean, those are very modern questions that, you know, they're likely going to change. I mean, 10 years from now, maybe nobody's going to be emailing anymore. We're only texting. And then 10 years after that, we're doing something else. And, you know, so those are very short-lived, temporary questions. The issues that I deal with in this book are timeless. You know, they're the things that we mentioned earlier, you know, creativity and integrity and grit and hard work and kindness and patience and humility. And the situations that people are in where they struggle with those things vary across time. But the lessons don't, and the character attributes you're looking for don't. So I've tried to use, and out of the hundreds and hundreds of stories I collected, the ones I used are the ones that I think can stand the test of time the longest. And, you know, maybe it's probably time for me to share another one with you, and that'll maybe help illustrate that a little
bit. Yeah, absolutely. And if there's a particular subject you'd like to address, feel free to.
Yeah, well, so let's pick, you know, kindness and how you treat other people. So one of my favorites is about a young man named Chad, who, when he was in high school, his senior year, he was the captain of the basketball team. And the night before a big game, the rest of the team was over at his house for dinner and strategizing about the game the next day. And it's probably not too surprising that a group of high school boys at some point during the evening are going to end up talking about high school girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they did. But at one point, their conversation turned to a very particular girl, and I'll just call her Jenny. And Jenny was a very special girl, though. And she spent her days in a wheelchair. She was blind in at least one eye, I believe. She was missing one arm and had some difficulty, you know, moving the other one, and had difficulty with speech, and, you know, so had a number of very visible physical disabilities. So you can imagine the kind of things that they were saying about her were not nice.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll just leave it at that. And well, at some point during the evening, Chad's father overheard them talking about Jenny. And in fact, it was his son, Chad, who started the conversation about Jenny. And what he did about it was just amazing. So the next day at school, he shows up at school unannounced at lunchtime, walks into the cafeteria, finds his son, Chad, sitting there at a table having lunch with basically the same guys that were at the house last night, the basketball
team.
He walks up and he says, "Chad, where's the girl?" And, of course, Chad immediately knows what he's talking about. He says, "Oh, my gosh, Dad, I'm so sorry. Please don't embarrass me here in front of my friends. I'm really sorry about what we said about, you know, Jenny last night." But his dad didn't give up. He said, "Son, where's the girl?" And he points over to a table in the middle of the room that had Jenny sitting at it eating lunch, probably by herself. And he said, "All right, Chad, I need you and the rest of your buddies to get up with me right now, and I need you to follow me over there to Jenny's table." And he convinced them all to do that, although, you know, they weren't too happy about it. He gets there, they all sit down, and he asks Jenny four questions that just forever change the way they think about treating and talking about other people. He asked, "Who's your best friend?" And she actually, since she had trouble speaking, she had one of those computers that she typed her words and the computer synthesized her voice, like a Stephen Hawking or something.
Uh-huh.
So it took her a while to answer. So the answer to the question was, of who's your best friend, was my mom, Stacy. Now, the truth is that probably spoke a lot more about her lack of social network at school than it did about her wonderful relationship with her mom.
Right.
And that wasn't lost on those boys, right? The second question was, what does your dad do for a living? And her answer was, I don't know who my father is. Okay, another pause-inducing answer, right?
Uh-huh.
The third question was, how long have you been in a wheelchair? And she types out, my whole life. Now, and here are these boys that spend their days running up and down and jumping on a basketball court, and here they're realizing this girl has never done that and she never will. But it was the last question that really just kind of finished this off nicely. The father asked, what is it you dream of and love to do the most? And her answer was, and remember that she's at least partially blind. She says, I love listening to the girls cheer at the boys' basketball games. Okay, the very boys that last night were making fun of her favorite thing in life to do is listen to the cheerleaders cheer them on. So
wow.
If there was any shame left that hadn't come out at that point, it was all out then, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Now, good things happened after that. You know, by then, the whole, you know, half the school was listening to this conversation and eavesdropping. And so everybody became aware very quickly that, you know what, we all treat Jenny poorly. And we should, you know, we really shouldn't do that. Now that we've gotten to know her a little bit, you know, it's impossible to hear that story or to have been there and not treat her differently after that. And after hearing the story, it's really impossible not the next time, you know, you find yourself talking poorly about somebody. It's impossible to not think, wait a minute, do I know that person? Do I know who their best friend is or what their father does for a living or what their, you know, what their issues are, what their dreams are? Because if I did, I might not be so quick to make fun of them. And so that's the kind of story that I think just, it transcends time. I mean, there are going to be people that are different than you, you know, 1,000 years ago and 1,000 years from now. And teenagers are going to want to talk about them.
Right.
And that's the kind of story that can help them choose not to.
Well, and I think that's a beautiful one for you to choose to share, because it's the feeling that I got, I mean, from the book, and it goes right to the point of, you know, we're not going to be able to get a message across to our children by just saying, how dare you, don't ever talk about someone like that again.
Right. That doesn't work.
Yeah, that doesn't work, but yet that seems to be the immediate knee-jerk response, unfortunately, by many of us as parents. And so, again, I think, again, it's just a good example of how, you know, just telling a story had so much more impact, and I give that father a lot of credit, because he not only made a positive impact on his own son, but probably the whole team. You know, so
right.
and eventually maybe the whole school. So
right. But you know, to tie this all back to your listener's question about, are there stories that are just not relevant today? Yes, I'm sure there are. So if you're chastising your kid for playing, you know, too many video games, and you tell them, look, when I was your age, I didn't spend my days playing video games. Well, guess what? That's not very compelling, because they didn't have video games when you were a kid, or all they had was Space Invaders and Pac-Man, and those weren't that interesting, you know. So, yeah, you can clearly tell an irrelevant, uncompelling story. But I've tried to weed those out and just leave the ones left that I think would be, you know, like I said, transcend time and be compelling for all kids of all ages.
Now, what would be one of your favorite stories as it relates to friendship? Because I know that in talking to some of the kids that we deal with, they put this huge amount of stress to the friendship of some of their peers, and they make it so incredibly important. And yet, on the other hand, you know, that family, you know, that they can kind of do whatever they want or say whatever they want, and it somehow isn't important. Have you had stories that somehow address that issue?
Yeah, maybe. Let me try this one. One of the people, and this is one that asked me to keep their name confidential, so I'll just make a name up, call it Sally, and her mom had a teenage girl and her mom, and typically teenage girls and their mom, it's not unusual for them to have a strained relationship. I guess any teenager and their parent often have strained relationships, but theirs was so bad that they were actually going to counseling over it.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of those counseling sessions, the daughter, Sally, was complaining that her mom's friend had said something mean about her. And in fact, she said, you know, well, my mom's friend, whoever, said that I was fat and lazy or something like that. And, of course, mom was, I've never heard her say anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, she did, and I don't like her. And, you know, the argument ensued about that. And so mom, the counselor, kind of challenged her, said, well, how do you know she said that, you know, because your mother has never heard her say that? And she said, well, you know, I don't want to give away my sources. I'll just say that, you know, it was said in front of one of my friends at the drop-off line at school. And of course, she's my friend, so she told me. And the counselor's response was, let me get this straight. You didn't hear this woman say that about you. Your mom didn't hear this woman say that about you. You only heard it second or third hand from a friend of yours. And she said, yeah, that's right. And the counselor said, you know, it sounds to me like you need better friends.
Uh-huh.
And she just said, what do you mean? She's a great friend of mine. She's looking out for me. She's telling me when people are talking about me. And the counselor said, I think you've got a pretty poor definition of friendship. She said, a good friend would protect you from hurtful things like that, not bring them to your attention. You know, so you shouldn't think about a friend as somebody who's going to run around and find all the hurtful things about you. You didn't have your feelings hurt when that woman said that about you. You had your feelings hurt when your friend told you about it. You know, so I think we all probably need to readjust our definition of friendship. And friends aren't somebody that's always going to tell you the truth or tell you what, you know, everything they know. I mean, a good friend is looking out for your better interests. You know,
yep.
Not to share gossip.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point is, you know, to get them at that point to think about what was the motivation of that friend, supposed friend, you know,
right.
what was their motivation? How, you know, what do you think they were thinking when they said that? You know, so, yeah, I think that's a great point. We've got about 5 minutes left. We've got another an instant message that is coming across. And this one reads, my husband and I have two children, a tween and a teen. My husband is a born storyteller, so much so that I sometimes envy his ability to capture their attention and how they look to him for advice. I may never be as good as he is at weaving a talk, but it sounds like your book would give me the skills to join in the fun. Wow, that was nice.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it was written for. It was mostly written to give you the stories to tell, and I hope that I've written them well, and so that you know you can kind of just tell them roughly as written. But I sense a little bit of insecurity in that question. In that, you know, my husband's a great storyteller, and I'm not. In that sometimes people think, in order to be a good storyteller, I've got to have this, you know, a good speaking voice, and I've got to tell the story in a, you know, with all kinds of emotion and inflection in my voice, and kind of that I have to be a good actor and public speaker to be a good storyteller. And I don't think that's true at all, certainly not with telling stories to your kids. In fact, what I try and counsel people is, you know, because people ask me all the time, well, how do I memorize these stories? You know, especially if it's not one that happened to me. And my answer is very simple. Don't.
Uh-huh.
Don't memorize these stories. I mean, who wants to listen to a story that sounds like it's been memorized? Nobody. Right? I mean, first of all, these are your kids, and they love you, right? You're telling a story to somebody that loves you. So they don't really care if you flub your lines a little bit. So just relax, first of all.
Uh-huh.
But second of all, I think the best advice I could give you about how to remember and deliver a story well is if it's something that you read, then go read it two or three or four times to yourself. Just enough to get the basic plot line down. So you understand basically what happened in the story. Then imagine that thing happened down the street an hour ago and you were there to witness the whole thing. Now, go tell somebody what happened in your own words. Okay? Then the story will become yours. You will tell it in your words the way that you envision the story happening. And you won't need to have memorized the words that I wrote or that somebody else wrote. It will become your story. And again, you're telling it to people that love you. So relax. You're probably a better storyteller than you think.
Well, and which brings up another point, as you bring up, that's sort of one of the barriers. But what about the barrier that I think you discuss in the book as well, but you know, what's your suggestion when they just say, you know, I'm not sure when to tell the story, you know, what would you say to that? What is the best time?
Yeah. So there's three that kind of come to mind quickly. First of all is that dinner time that we talked about earlier that's kind of gone away, the dinner time storytelling. You could do yourself a favor and your kids by just reinstituting dinner time conversation, and that's when you can share stories. You know, bedtime is another obvious one, especially for the younger kids. You know, my youngest kid now asks me every night to tell him a story at bedtime, but he's not talking about one in some, you know, Mother Goose book. He wants to know a real story about some real kid somewhere now that he knows I've got all these stories, right?
Uh-huh.
So they will seek you out and ask you for them. But I think the best time to tell a story, and I think we touched on this earlier, is opportunistically. You know, it's when you see your kid struggling with whatever problem, then that's time to whip out a story about that topic. You know, as opposed to saying, you know, sit down and be quiet and listen, I'm going to tell you a story now. You know, that's very, very prescriptive and like a school lecture. But just that's the time to bring up the stories when you see your kid needs it.
I love it. And I think that's a perfect way for us to wrap this up. Paul, thank you so much. The time has flown by. Again, for everybody out there, if you go to leadwithastory.com, you can get all the information. Is there any other site that they can go to, Paul, or is that the best one?
That's probably the best one. I've got a podcast where I share a lot of these types of stories. So for any of your listeners that are there, podcasters, they can find information about the podcast there, or find Parenting with a Story on iTunes or Stitcher or something like that.
Okay, that's great. So Parenting with a Story on iTunes or Stitcher. I know that I'm going to check it out because I'm much more auditory, so I like hearing it as much as I do reading it. So, again, thank you so much, Paul. For everybody out there, thank you for listening to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith right here on LA Talk Radio.